This episode of the Real-Time History Podcast is sponsored by Nebula. Subscribe to Nebula to listen to this podcast and watch all our real-time history videos earlier and ad-free. You also get access to exclusive historical deep-dive documentaries like our World War II series 16 Days in Berlin and Rhineland 45 on the dramatic and decisive final stage of the Second World War. Sign up for Nebula at nebula.tv/realtimehistorypodcast for just $30 for an entire year and support this show.
Even though production ended in 1945, they were only written off in like 1993. By that point, most of them were just rotting in storage or being used as range targets. But this is an extremely long-living vehicle.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Real-Time History Podcast. And today, we are going to get a little bit technical, so to speak. We've got a very special guest once again. We have Peter Samsonov with us today. He's the man behind the Tank Archives blog, which if you're into tanks, folks, you probably already know about. He's also published numerous tank-related articles via Wargaming Group Limited, which is the company behind the online game World of Tanks. And he's also the author of two previous books on Soviet tanks. And today, we're going to talk about another Soviet tank that is the focus of his newest book, which is about the IS-2 Soviet heavy tank of World War II. And the book is called IS-2, Development, Design, and Production of Stalin's Warhammer. So Peter, glad to have you. I'm not the kind of guy who's into the technical details of tanks, so this is an opportunity for me to discover something new based on at least attempting to read the book and keep track of all the different technical and development aspects. Thank you for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
Let's talk about Peter. A lot of people are somewhat interested in tanks. Not a lot of people end up writing multiple books about the design and evolution of Soviet tanks. How did you get into this whole topic? And then in particular, why did you decide to tackle the IS-2 and not another tank that you haven't yet worked on?
So ironically, my family is chiefly tied to the Navy. There's not a lot of tankers among us, but I grew up in Moscow and not a lot of ships going up and down the Moscow River, but there is no shortage of tank museums. And while I was growing up, the Kubinka Tank Museum, which to many is still the holy grail of tank museums worldwide, it became open to the public. It used to be a closed off army base. That's what they were doing, you know, experiments on experimental tanks, capture tanks, etc. It became open to the public, and there was a huge, huge museum attached to it. And yet events were, as a child, I would climb on tanks, climb into tanks. Now, in retrospect, these were probably more modern, probably not even tanks, probably IFVs, but it was enough to kind of make that seed, right? Where you read about a ship or you read about a plane, and it's like, okay, well, here's this concept of something in my mind. But the tank is, it's right there. You know, you can touch it, you can climb on it, you can press some buttons, have some sergeant yell at you. And then when I left Russia, that interest just sort of, you know, was dormant for many years until I started playing World of Tanks. And for all the flack Wargaming catches for not being very historically accurate, there is, or at least there was, a considerable part of the community that was interested in historical tanks. And the Wargaming staff fed that community pretty well. So there were a lot of researchers that wrote articles, that published all the materials that they found while they were doing research for Wargaming. And of course, there was a lot of arguments on the World of Tanks forums, where the documents and the articles that they published would come in handy. And so what actually, those arguments typically grew very heated. So what would happen without...
I'm shocked.
Without fail is I would post a translation of a document in some thread. People would write those Soviet propaganda, you know, there would be heated, harsh words said. Mods would come in, delete the thread, and rinse and repeat and rinse and repeat. And so I thought, I'm wasting my time reposting the same thing over and over. Why don't I just make some kind of off-site resource, keep the translations there, just link to them. And so I did that. 10 years have gone by this February. My site, Tank Archives, still around. I think the World of Tanks historical forums are no longer around. And the community generally has changed, obviously, in the past year or so, changed considerably, but my interest in tanks is going strong. I mean, I wrote some articles here and there, and like you said, for Wargaming, I became you know, one of those researchers that put the stuff out for both for World of Tanks and for historical branch of wargaming, and hopefully inspire, you know, the next generation of historians as well. I was actually approached by a publisher and they asked me to write a book, or if I ever considered writing a book. And I said, well, no, sounds like a lot of effort. And they said, well, it's actually not that much effort. It's, was it 24,000 words and 80 pictures, I think the requirement was. And I thought, well, my articles are about 2,000 words and I write, give or take, 10 articles a year. So if I just wrote a book for a year instead of articles, that's a book. And so I went and did it. And I think as anybody who has any kind of hobby knows, while you're working on a project, they'll get ideas for 5 other projects. And then the trick is just not to abandon your current one and start working on one of those. It's harder to abandon your project when you sign a contract and money is on the line. But
yeah, let's just say I feel targeted by that statement, but move on. Let's move on.
I think a lot of our listeners will find this very relatable. But yeah, I got the idea for writing my Sherman book while I was writing my T-34 book, and that was published because of the pandemic. It was delayed by about a year and a half, but that was published in 2021. And around that time, I was, you know, the publishers really were doing all that much stuff. And Bernard from Military History Visualized reached out to me for some information about the IS-2. He was doing a video on it, and he did his video, but he was left dissatisfied with the quality of English language sources on the IS-2 tank. And so he suggested, hey, let's do an IS-2 book. You know, he can research the German side, I can research the Soviet side. And well, what came out in the end, this, as always, we wanted to put everything in one book, and the project kind of grew out of control. So this is the kind of reduced scope, stage one, right? IS-2 design, development, and production. Same as my T-34 book. This is about the design. This is about how the design came to be. This is about how the design evolved. And this is about how the tank eventually became unsatisfactory and was replaced.
Well, that sounds like a sad ending, but trust me, it had an interesting life before it got to that point.
Well, and that's the thing is, the IS-2, even though production ended in 1945, they were only written off in like 1993. So this is an incredibly, and by that point, most of them were just rotting in storage or being used as range targets. But this is an extremely long-living vehicle. I think there's something like 2 IS-2s in museums without post-war modernization. But it's, like I say, it wasn't satisfactory. It was replaced. That doesn't mean its service ended. I don't think it means it's a sad ending. But yeah, in terms of combat, that was one of the biggest pieces of feedback about my first book is people were sad there wasn't any combat in it. If I was going to write a book about the combat of the T-34, it would be a massive 1,000-page tome. I would not get that delivered on time. So same thing here. We'll leave that for the future. This book has proving grounds trials. If you want to read about the IS-2 shooting at tigers, shooting at panthers, it's all there, just not on the battlefield.
All right. So to get our listeners in the mood, what kind of vehicle are we talking about, and its kind of historical context? So let us begin with the basics here. What is the IS-2 tank, and what was its purpose in the Red Army of late World War II?
So the IS-2 was a heavy tank, and it's one of those terms that people don't really think about a lot, but its meaning changes quite a bit depending on the era, depending on, you know, even the army that the tank fights for. So specifically in the Red Army, heavy tanks started out as part of specialized heavy tank brigades for breaking through 4-5 lines. Now, before the war, that was T-28s, which were classified as heavy tanks, and T-35s. And they were collected into specialized heavy tank brigades. Now, in 1930-1940, there was a lot of reorganization of Soviet tank units, and these heavy tank brigades were actually merged into regular tank first divisions. And then when the divisions fell apart, because it turns out tank divisions weren't really all that good, into regular tank brigades. And so it was a sort of regression where a heavy tank was just a big heavy tank. It wasn't a specialized breakthrough implement. The KVs by that point were just, you know, every tank brigade would have something like 10 KVs, 30 T-34s, 30 E-60s, something like that. The numbers are a bit off, but it was kind of that proportion. And towards, even before actually the IS-2 came into service, you see this rediscovery of the specialized heavy tank units, with the KV-1S by that point being taken out of regular tank brigades and combined into these specialized heavy tank regiments. The analogy that I like to use is an arrow. So a heavy tank brigade or heavy tank regiments, heavy tank brigades came much later, is the arrowhead. It's what you need to punch through, you know, your targets, punch through their armor. If your arrowhead is blunt, if it's dull, your attack isn't going to do anything. It's just going to bounce off. It won't do much damage. But if you don't have a shaft behind the arrowhead, it's just a bad knife. If you don't have fletching on that arrow, it's not going to hit the target, so it doesn't matter how good the arrowhead is. So a heavy tank is a specialized asset that does one thing. It breaks through stuff. And the name of these, by the time the IS-2 came into service, these tank heavy tank brigades were named Guards Heavy Tank Breakthrough Brigades. The idea is you break through the enemy line. I'm not sure how familiar your listeners are with the deep battle concept, but the idea is you break through the enemy line, you send in exploitation forces. The exploitation forces are fast, light. Well, by that point in the war that the IS-2 came in, usually medium tanks. The IS-2's job by that point is done. So the idea is a short-range engagement, maybe 100 kilometers, probably even less, chiefly against also very heavy enemy assets that are identified in advance. So an enemy heavy tank, in this case, battalions, enemy fortifications, etc., etc. Now, this is, of course, the idealized version of events. A lot of the time, if the IS-2 is the only tank you have, then it's the only tank you have. Combined arms commanders see something with a big gun and with armor, with tracks, and they say, awesome, tank, send it into battle. And it doesn't matter if it's an SU-76 or a T-34 or an IS-2, but the idealized version of events is that the IS-2 is a very, very specialized asset.
So a tank is better than no tank, can still be applicable even to a specialized vehicle like this one, a breakthrough vehicle, if you will.
Right, yeah. And there was actually, I didn't get to the combat history in this book, but definitely it's a topic for a later book, is there's this ongoing slap fight between frontline commanders that see a tank and say, awesome, into battle you go, and senior commanders say, hey, we only have like 30 of these for the entire army, so please don't throw them wherever. And actually, you see a very similar thing on the German side. I have captured documents that say, if you want to use a Tiger tank, think for a little bit, will Panzer IV do? Because, it's conversion devolution. These tactics of using very big, very heavy tanks as opposed to smaller, cheaper, lighter, medium tanks. Everybody's tempted to just throw the biggest, heaviest thing they happen to battle, but sometimes it's not the best policy.
All right, so I guess now we've bitten off quite a chunk, and we'll return to different parts of that over the course of our chat here. But I guess it's fair to say, yeah, the IS-2 is an expression of this expansion in size, I guess, of individual armored designs. And if the Germans are trying to hold a line somewhere, if everything goes according to the theory, it should be one of the first things that they see before they start rolling backwards. If we're gonna oversimplify it for a little bit. A lot of alarm bells are going off in my head because, of course, there's been so much talk about tanks in the news in the past year that I've no doubt that some of our listeners are making connections as well, including the improvisation and throwing whatever kind of steel you've got at the other side, because that's not unique to World War II. I think we've been seeing some of that in the past year as well. So enough about the steel for a moment. That idea of a tank's kind of life cycle is something that I was thinking about when I read the book. And I wanted to ask you about the phases of development, because I think that for a lay person who's not into it, you know, well, okay, some engineer draws up the plans for a big piece of steel with tracks and a gun, and then the factory makes it, and then they like drive them out, and there we go. Now we're shooting at Germans and stuff, right? It's much, much more complex than that. But can you kind of summarize the sort of main stages or main phases of like development, design, testing and stuff that a tank would have to go through before it even ends up then on the front line somewhere shooting at somebody? I was surprised, because I'm not, you know, a super tank guy, let's say, I was surprised at how many dead ends there are always on the way to developing tanks. It's something also being at the, having visited the Tank Museum in Bovington in England several times, I was also struck by that there. And then I saw that pattern kind of coming again in with the IS-2. So can you try to kind of summarize, you know, how does it get from somebody's idea to a piece of steel with a capability?
Sure. So I think you're right that the layperson's understanding of any engineering is an engineer has an idea. And a lot of, unfortunately, so I have an engineering education. Unfortunately, a lot of my colleagues also have the same idea. That's not entirely correct. The engineering process begins at setting a requirement. And that's why my book starts in the early 1920s rather than 1944. In order to build a tank, you need to know what you want. And for the military, this just depends on your doctrine. And so there's a, in the introduction chapter, you know, if you think, I want a heavy tank, so I'm just going to build a tank that's heavy, great. You now have a tank that weighs 1,000 tons. Or there were more, this is where Grothe, who later designed the P-1000, this is where he got his start in his super heavy tanks. The USSR was inviting all these foreign engineers, and they said, design us a heavy tank and make these horrible monstrosities that you would never be able to put into production. And so there's this, so engineering is always a balance. It's always a compromise. In this case, it was a compromise of what does the army want versus what can our industry actually deliver. T-35 was, for its time, pretty good. People make fun of it for being ineffective by 1941, but that was a decade had passed and multiple turrets had gone out of style. Guns were invented that could penetrate more than 30 millimeters of armor, et cetera, et cetera. But for its time, was actually pretty good.
So the T-35, just for those who are not familiar, this was this very unusual looking, multiple turreted Soviet tank of the like 30s, basically,
yes,
right?
Yeah, so it had one big turret on top and then four smaller turrets. It's more like a battleship. You know, British tanks are called landships, I think, this one. There was even a project to put a rangefinder from a battleship onto it to control all these multiple turrets. But anyway, so that was the outcome of this first iteration of the engineering process. By 1938, it was recognized that, hey, this tank we built, you know, 7 years ago, it's too heavy, it's too slow, we can't upgrade the armor, we need a iteration of design. And so that's how you got the KV-1. It's a similar concept, application of modern technologies for the time to it. The weird spring bogey suspension made way for torsion bars. They got rid of all the extra turrets. There was actually a 45mm gun along with a 76mm gun in the turret to begin with originally, but that gun dropped because there wasn't any room for it. And so you can kind of see this evolution of similar concept, similar weight class around 40 tons, 76mm main gun. If you look at the front shape of the hull, very similar after the hull. Very similar. So it wasn't really a revolution. It was an evolution. It's an old concept you applied new ideas to. And so KV-1 was great. There was iterative upgrades to it, you know, more armor, bigger gun, the new generation of heavy tanks that was going to come about in 1941. Same thing, thicker armor, bigger gun, not really, you know, longer hull to fit a bigger engine, not really any kind of huge forward leap. And then the war starts. And so now that kind of engineering requirements, they've shifted considerably because beforehand you had a little bit of leeway. Now it's, we need tanks, I need tanks now. I don't care. Like, you know, we keep coming back to a tank is better than no tank. And so all these simplifications are made to the design. And Soviet tanks made extensive use of lighter alloys. So aluminum, particularly. Aluminium is rare and it's expensive. If you're throwing your pop can into recycling, you might not think about it. But if you need thousands and thousands of tons to build engines, well, it's going to be a little bit harder to obtain. Presses. The KV used a lot of curved armor. You need very powerful, very expensive presses. Odds are you only had one in Leningrad. Leningrad is now under siege. What are you going to do? You need to weld the armor. You don't have that nice curve. You have an angle. That's always more weight, right? And you're always looking at cutting down on cost, cutting down production time. And so the KV-1 ballooned up from 45-ish tons to over 50 tons because of these simplifications. And cover this in the book, but in the beginning of 1942, there's all of these initiatives to get the weight down, get the weight down. It results in the KV-1S. The KV-1S is very unsatisfactory because really all they did is they had a nice new turret, but the hull was lightened just by taking armor off. And that's no one likes that. No one likes having less armor in a newer tank.
Not the crew anyway, that's for sure.
Yeah. And so now it was time for a revolutionary leap. How can we take 120mm of armor, and 120mm key because that was the penetration of the Sherman 36, the 8mm gun. how can I take 120 millimeters of armor and create a heavy tank that weighs 40-ish tons again? And then the factory designers came back and said, you can't. We can't make a tank that you want. It's impossible. You can't fit this much stuff into such a small package. Plus, if we do all these things, it'll take time. We won't be able to reuse existing equipment. And there was a lot of back and forth. You know, people really view the Soviet system, the command economy, as this kind of like Stalin's at the top. He gives orders. The orders trickle down to the people's commissariats. The people's commissariats issue orders to the factories, and everyone works, you know, in lockstep as this ideal machine of workers. And it could not be further from the truth. Requirements issued to the designers. The designers say we don't have time. We can't be bothered. You know, if you put this into production now, we're going to need new equipment. So please get us this equipment. Want to cut a bigger turret ring? Great. Can't do it at our factory. Someone has to subcontract another factory. And honestly, when I'm reading all these historical documents, to what I do today, nothing's changed. the numbers are different, the currencies are different, but there's always a lot of background work even before the engineer sits down back then and, you know, the drafting table now in like AutoCAD or something. A lot of work has to go into it. And so I get into it in great detail in the book, but you had the KV-13 project, and it was a compromise that was driven by the engineers. So they said, here's this thing we can build here and now. And it had 120 millimeters of armor, but not much else going for it. So it had the correct weight, but it's not a narrow turret ring, two-man turrets. It went through trials, and it wasn't any good, but you'll see this in Soviet tanks a lot, is the core concept proves to be correct, but the implementation leaves much to be desired. And so the commissioner will say, sure, we could put this into production, but fix this, 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 and this. And sometimes it's a quick fix, and sometimes it requires a whole new prototype. Same KV-13. There's two tanks called KV-13. They're very different. So the tank that came into trials in the spring of 1943 was a very different tank based on now not only on what the designers wanted to do, but actually more on what the army wanted to drive. And that tank did okay in trials. It was a recommendation to put it into pilot production, kind of doing something similar to what the British did with the Covenanter, and then the Churchill, is to, you know, maybe build a couple hundred of these, put them out there, see what happens. I don't know how realistic that proposal was, but everything changed again when the Tiger showed up. I'll get to that later, but it's suffice it to say the requirements changed again. And you had to build a whole new tank, test the whole new tank. And everybody had their input. The army had their input. The designers had their input. There was actually fierce competition around what gun you even put into this thing, which I also covered in the book. The Soviet artillery bureaus had as much competition between them as the tank bureaus did. It's not like there was just one guy making guns and that's the only gun you had. And the IS-1 that you get in the fall of 1943, it's the conclusion of a process that started years and years ago. You know, you can't look at the requirements written in 1938 and say we're going to end up with the IS-1. Not really how design works. But in the book, I go through all these steps about how it iterates, how the requirements change, how everybody has their input into these requirements.
And that led me to another thing that I was wondering, because there's all these different, well, to use a corporate buzzword that probably wouldn't have been used at the time, stakeholders in the process, right? Who not only have certain requirements or limitations or differently defined roles, but also different agendas, different priorities, or maybe even different relationship networks and so forth that might play into this whole long process from requirements to a functional vehicle. And on a few occasions in the book, I saw the phrase that some decision was made and Stalin accepted it. So I know we always want to focus on, you know, these great men in history, blah, blah. That's not really my approach to history in general, but it stuck out at me because obviously he's not a tank designer. Okay. He's a lot of things, but he ain't no tank designer, right? So what is this? Like you said, it's not really a top-down thing, but what role, if any, does the very top echelon have? Because, of course, we hear about, you know, Hitler interfering in certain designs for certain weapons, or Churchill trying to interfere in certain designs for certain weapons, less successfully, thankfully. What is Stalin doing in all this? So why does he end up having to accept some of the decisions related to this?
Sure. So Stalin actually did design one tank. It's called the KV-7. If you are in a position to look up some pictures of it, do it now and have a laugh. But if you're not...
Okay, I was going to say, I have just been outed as a non-Stalin connoisseur here, but I feel like that's a bit of a hidden gem. He designed his own crappy tank. Interesting. Sorry.
Yeah, you know, we had a fixed case made. It had a 176 millimeter gun, 245 millimeter gun. He built and tested it. It was terrible. That was his first and last foray to tank design.
Okay, so he was not a tank designer. I'm safe with that characterization.
But there is a huge reorganization of Soviet production that happens because of the war. Before the war, and I go into this in my T-34 book as well, all these tank production facilities are spread between different ministries. So People's Commissariat is the Soviet equivalent of ministry. And People's Commissar is a minister. So armor is produced for the People's Commissar of Ferrous Metals. Tanks, depending on the weight, are produced for People's Commissar of Medium or Heavy Machine Building. The electrical components are People's Commissar of something else, communications, I think. And you have all of these different... An actual factory, obviously, is so many, many layers down that when it comes time to organize production, you're negotiating with the people who are removed from the situation on the ground, right? And obviously, when senior manager argues on our behalf, they have their own priorities, and it was a huge mess. One of the things we see with the start of the war is the establishment of two People's Commissariat. One is the People's Commissariat of Tank Production, which gathered under it every factory involved in tank production. So no longer did you have to have all these cabinet meetings just to figure out how to, you know, change the T-34's armor from one alloy to another. It was all under one guy, and it improved things quite considerably in terms of output and aligning everybody and reacting to changes at one factory and all the other factories. The other thing was the formation of the People's Commissariat of Defense. So Korea had the Council of Defense within the People's Council of Commissars, and it was, again, this sort of all the ministers gathered together in a room talking at a very high level about defense decisions. Very slow, very arduous process, works in peacetime, kind of doesn't really work during the war at all. So the People's Commissar of Defense made all of the decisions related to defense, obviously, of the USSR. And Stalin, as the chairman of the Council of People's Commissar of Defense, Beria was his deputy, which is why you see Beria's signature on a lot of things as well. They were the ones to finalize all of these decisions. So you'll actually see orders by the People's Commissar of Defense that say, hey, we need a new tank. Then the People's Commissariat of Tank Production issues an order to its designers, to its factories, saying, here are the requirements for this new tank. And then once the design is done, once all the trials have been run through, they send a draft decree back up to the Commissar of Defense and say, hey, tank's done, sign this. And it's a process. It's not like Stalin has his blueprints out there and he says, you know, make the armor thicker, change this, whatever, or gearbox. It's an organizational thing. So, and then Stalin writes the thing saying, you know, so-and-so, People's Commissariat of Armament, for example, putting the IS-2 into production, right? People's Commissar of Armaments, which is still a different thing than tanks, has to begin producing 122 millimeter Commissar of Ammunition, has to begin producing 122 millimeter shells, stuff like that. So these are the decisions that were made at a high level. There's a site documents from the Soviet archives, puts them up, and they actually scan the copies that were issued to the People's Commissariat of Defense. And you can actually see Stalin's notes that he made on these things. And sometimes he'll suggest changes. Very often, it's literally just a decree from the People's Commissar of Tank Production, you know, with Stalin's signature on it, just rubber stamped and looks fine, right? Ship it. So he was the final decision maker, but the decisions arrived kind of pre-made. Stalin didn't, you know, he wasn't really out there with the blueprints and the drawing boards.
Thank heavens for the Red Army, because I just Googled the KV-7 and yeah, you don't want to be using that as your war-winning weapon here. This brings me, because I was thinking when you mentioned KV-7 and I quickly Googled it and I got this image burned into my frontal cortex now. But, you know, I was thinking, how effective would that be or not be, primarily, on a battlefield? And I was thinking that when I was reading the book as well about the IS-2, because, of course, as you mentioned, tank priorities and these requirements and so on, they're influenced by what the enemy is doing and what machines the enemy brings onto the battlefield. And the IS-2 comes around at a time when the Germans already have some much improved tanks, right? So they already have Tigers, they already have Panthers. To what extent is the IS-2 really a direct response to those vehicles? And how does it compare to them, not only in its technical capabilities, but in something that I always find interesting, which is the crew conditions and the ergonomics? And, you know, how is the experience of an IS-2 crewman different to the experience of a Tiger crewman, for example, right? So maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
Sure. It is quite frequently claimed that the IS-2 is a response to the Tiger. That is entirely untrue. A more correct statement would be that the IS-1 partially is a response to the Tiger, particularly the armament.
For the record, I said to what extent, and I meant to what extent, if any, just for anybody out there.
A little bit. The history goes, the KV-13 was evolved into the IS-1. When I say IS-1, I say Object 233. Well, the term object wasn't used yet, but the tank with blueprint index 233. That tank was tested. It was found to be, that was the tank that they wanted to put into pilot production. It was okay, but there were a lot of changes that they wanted to do, particularly lengthen the hull to kind of reduce ground pressure, expand the turret a little bit. There were a list of changes, none of them particularly revolutionary, but it's still, the tank still needed to go to the drawing board. This was around April of 1943. In April of 1943, the Red Army finally gets around to shooting up the Tiger tank that they captured back in January. And the results are not great. It turns out that the 76mm gun, the SIS-5 on the KV-1, the F-34, the towed SIS-3, all around the same ballistics, that gun does not penetrate the front of the tank at all. And it penetrates the side at a very close range. Again, if at all. So this is very bad, because now the enemy has this tank that our new perspective heavy tank, because the IS-1 at that point still had the old 76mm gun, can't fight. And so this was where the alarm bells started ringing, is we need a bigger gun. And thankfully, as a part of those trials, they shot a whole bunch of other calibers at it, one of which was the 85mm A8 gun, which, like, so the Soviet 85mm A8 gun, the 52K, descends actually from a Rheinmetall 76mm A8 gun purchased from Germany in like the late 20s or something like that.
I was going to say, this is a legacy of the Weimar and Soviet Union rapprochement in the 20s, right? Coming back. Yeah.
And so the German 88mm Flak 36 gets a lot of people say, oh, it's this awesome legendary gun. You know, it's used, it's dual purpose. It's so revolutionary. It's used for both anti-aircraft and groundwork. The Soviets used their A8 guns for groundwork as well. They also had multi-purpose gun mounts. They also had gun shields. To great effect.
Quiet, Peter. Quiet, quiet. You're ruining the internet's dreams.
Don't do it. And so there were already 85mm armor-piercing rounds, and, you know, a shooter to the Tiger penetrates the front at almost a kilometer and a half and leaves a nice jagged hole. And so, hey, let's put this into production. Why not? And this, the first 85mm gun project, and I get this in the book as well, dates back to 1941, but that was less. We need more firepower and more. We've moved tank production to the Urals. We're now shipping our 76mm guns thousands of kilometers. What happens if the supply line goes out? We need to replace that. The only barrels we have local are 85mm, so we got to build an 85mm gun. And so a gun was designed, it was never put into production just because they didn't need it at the time. And then in the spring of 1943, everybody's dusting off their old 85mm gun blueprints. And so now here's where it gets interesting. The requirement was reuse as many parts from this 5 gun as possible. And so Vasily Grabin's design bureau followed the rules. And they made a gun that was the S-31. It was okay. It met these requirements. And now at the factory number 9 design bureau, I forget who that was headed by, but it's all in the book. He said, nah, we're going to ignore these requirements. To hell with it. We're going to remake the same ballistics, same 85mm barrel. We're going to do our own thing. And they made the D5 gun. And the D5 gun was actually a lot more compact. And so
I would just like to point out, I've seen the original documents, and that is exactly what he said in Russian. Yeah, just for anyone who's wondering.
And so there were competing trials, and the D5 gun turned out to be a lot better. And, well, sorry not sorry, but this is out there. And so what if it doesn't meet the requirements, but we'll change the requirements. Following the rules, I'm sorry if this is a bad example, setting a bad example to your younger viewers, but following the rules doesn't always pay off. And and so the IS-1 tank that went into production in the fall with this 85mm gun had an 85mm gun in order to fight a Tiger. Everything else probably would have been exactly the same if the Tiger hadn't showed up. Now, the Germans, they weren't polite enough to just kind of wait and see what the Soviets did. When the Tiger came out, they had the audacity to roll out new armored vehicles in the summer of 1943. And that would be the Panther and particularly the Ferdinand. And the Ferdinand really worried Soviet command. because you have German tanks in 1942 up to 50 millimeters of armor. German tanks in the spring, so when the Tiger was tested, they found it. Ferdinand comes out in the summer, 180 millimeters of armor. This doubling of the armor, they were going, holy moly, you know, next summer we're going to have a heavy tank out there with like 200 millimeters of armor. What are we going to do? Yeah, this 85 millimeter gun that we just put into production, like, fine, it bounces off the Panther's upper front plate. It still penetrate the turret or the lower front plate. But this, you know, we need something with heavier firepower out there right now. But again, we kind of go back to, we need a gun now, what's out there, what's available. The 122 millimeter gun was actually tested, so big core level bunker buster. They tested its armor piercing capability with actually concrete penetrating shells back in 1940 because it didn't have AP yet for it. And it was actually pretty good. It penetrated, I can't remember, 120 millimeters of armor with this, again, non-purpose made shell. And they kind of kept this in their back pocket as a solution for enemy heavy tanks. And, well, okay, here's a Steiger tank. It was used in the trials. The first shot actually came into a hole previously made in the Tiger tank, went all the way through, came out the back. That's not very interesting because it went into a pre-made hole. The second shot hit the turret, tore the turret out of the turret ring, and then displaced it backwards by a couple of centimeters. So they went, okay, this is a good gun. Let's put this in a tank. And so the work to put it in a tank actually began unofficially at that point. And then the same decree that accepted the IS-1 into service in the fall, the same decree says we need to make this, but with a 122-millimeter gun. So the IS-1's time was very limited. Even the decree that put it into service was like, yeah, but we're going to replace you really quickly. So yeah, so in that sense, the IS-1 was a response to Tiger. The IS-2 was a response to the Panther and Ferdinand. But remember, so we're wrapping back around to 120 millimeters of armor. Remember, 120 millimeters of armor is the max penetration of the Flak 36. Flak 36, obviously the gun on the Tiger has the same ballistics. So inadvertently, the armor on the IS-2 tank now also resists Tiger's gun because it's the same in ballistics. Unfortunately, yeah, the Germans aren't very cooperative. They put bigger guns. So the Panther's gun is only 75 millimeters, but it's higher velocity. So that has more penetration. 88 millimeter gun on the Ferdinand is longer. That has more penetration. And so IS-2 tanks in the spring of 1944, once the first IS-1s, IS-2s actually had time to fight Panthers and Tigers and, you know, took damage from them and came back to the factory and said, hey, how come there's holes in the front of my tank? There's this kind of return to, not the drawing board, but there's a big change to the front of the armor. So it goes from this sort of KV-1-like shape to a more T-34-like shape, and also a lot of longer-term projects to replace the IS-2. This is something that people don't realize. A lot of the time, the work to replace a tank starts as soon as the tank is done. In case of the Sherman, development of the Sherman began as soon as the Lee went into production. Development of the Tiger II began shortly after the before even the Tiger went into production, as they were wrapping up the design. Development of the T-34's replacement began in like January of 1941. In the IS-2's case, development of a replacement began in April of 1944. And that's normal. That happens all the time with armored vehicles. But the change to the IS-2 at that point was a direct consequence of the Ferdinand and the Panthers.
So I still want to follow up on the ergonomics question for the crew, though, because especially if you are shoving in a gun that was originally designed to be an artillery piece and now it's in a tank turret, I imagine it's not going to be that spacious in there.
Yes. So one of the biggest problems for the IS-2 was the rate of fire, because the D-25 gun inherited the screw breech from the A-19 core gun. And for anyone who doesn't have an artillery museum next door and can't go and see what a screw breech is, think of a massive screw. That's, you know, you put in your shell, you put in the propellant, you ram it all so it engages the driving band, and then you slam this huge screw behind it and screw it in. The gun fires. You unscrew the massive screw, you pull it towards you, now the shell ejects, and you have to work around this huge chunk of metal in front of you. And the rate of fire was not high. It's like 1.5 to 2 rounds per minute. I think a well-trained crew could get up to 3. But the loader is slinging the 25 kilogram, I don't know how much that is in pounds. chunks of metal.
55-ish,
something around that, yes. And the propellant casing is much lighter, only 15 kilograms. So rounding that in there, that was unsatisfactory. But again, we could have a good tank sometime in the future, or we could have this now. This is just pretty obvious. And in the spring of 1944, one of the biggest changes was a sliding breech. So more of what you think when you think about artillery. Thing that goes up and down, you put the shell in, you put the propellant in, you ram it all in, it closes up. This was a big change, and it increased the rate of fire to 4 to 6 rounds per minute when you're using the ready wrap. To get a little bit into technical details, a lot of people say, well, the Tiger can fire 15 rounds per minute, and the IS-2 can fire 1 round per minute, 2 rounds per minute. Obviously, the Tiger is better. This usually mixes up sustained aimed fire and rapid fire. So if you're comparing rates of fire figures and you don't know what they're measuring, those figures aren't of any value to you.
Right. It's like 10 unaimed rounds a minute is a whole different situation than, you know, 3 aimed rounds per minute.
Right. And usually in a lot of trials, so the Soviets, the way the trial happened is command is given to load. You open the breech, load a shell fire. Open the breech, load a shell fire. You do that for 2 or 3 minutes, and then you average out the result. That's your rate of fire. And I've seen trials, American or German trials, where you have a round in your breech already loaded. The command is given to fire. Fire the round, load another fire, load another fire. Timer stops, and then you say, I fired 3 rounds in 30 seconds. My rate of fire is 6 rounds per minute.
Yeah, but you already had the first one in there, so, right. So it's automatic. Quicker, right?
Completely different methodology. And I've even seen, this was for the ISU-152, sustained rate of fire trials, 60 shots in 39 minutes. Imagine the difference on the crew, on the loader, working for 30 seconds, regardless of what you're doing, working for 30 seconds versus working for 39 minutes. Very different approach. And again, it's not to say that one is better than the other. It's just that when you're measuring figures, make sure your figures are measuring the same. I get into that. It's one of those engineering things I get into in a lot of detail on the book. But in terms of general ergonomics, we talked a lot about the loader. The loader had the shorter end of the stick because, you know, it doesn't matter how well laid out your gun is or how great your workspace is. If you have to lift a chunk of metal that weighs 25 kilograms, it's going to be physically demanding. The rest of the crew actually had a pretty great time in comparison. If we're comparing them to German tanks...
Euphemistically speaking, of course.
Well, yeah, I mean, as far as being a tank crewman goes, if we're comparing them to German tanks have this sort of undeserved reputation for being comfortable because they're big. Being big doesn't necessarily mean it's comfortable. It all depends on the layout of the component inside the tank. There's a lot of very detailed ergonomic studies done by the British. They do one for the Tiger, the Panther, and the Tiger 2. And their conclusion is the tank is big, the tank is spacious, everything inside is very badly laid out. Like a gunner sits at the gunner's seat, the pedal to traverse the turret to the right is under his left foot, pedal to traverse the turret to the left is somewhere over there. And, you know, he has to twist his body if he wants to have his feet on the correct pedals. If he wants to use the gun sight, he can't have his headphones on because he can't get his head close to the side of the turret. There's a great video done at the Kubinka Tank Museum where it's kind of like Chieftain's Hatch, where the guy sits down in the commander station in the Panther and his elbow hangs inside the recoil guard because there's no room for it.
Okay, he's going to have a bad time.
You know, risk getting his hand lopped off by the recoil. And so that's the thing, is being a tank is crowded. A tank is cramped. Every tank is small. Every tank needs to have its components laid out very carefully in order for the crew to function effectively. Soviet's armor gets a bad rap. In reality, it's one of those things where if you start looking at the ergonomics documents, everything gets a lot more complicated. On my blog, I've translated this document and there's excerpts of it in the book as well. It was a medical study, an ergonomics study of the Object 240, so the IS-2 prototype. And there's a lot of things that they say, this is bad, move the seat, move the cupola, there's bulge out in the side of the turret because the cupola had tension paid to ergonomics, to the point where they're having people sit in mock-ups and kind of say, you know, in order, a fully grown person, so the average Soviet tanker was 170 centimeters tall, so it's not super tall, but it's also not a dwarf. And they'd measure, you know, they'd say, here's where the side should be, here's how tall your seat should be for the driver when you're sitting down, you know, your feet can be out this far. And all this medical data went into designing the tanks. So contrary to popular belief, the Soviets put a lot of effort into their tank design. when it came to ergonomics. Now, again, it's obviously a balance, right? The bigger you make a tank, the heavier it is, the easier it is to hit. So sometimes it pays off to make a smaller tank, maybe less comfortable. You're aiming for a tank that's comfortable enough to operate in for whatever. Yeah.
To get the job done, right? I think for maybe a final question, I want to try to take a step back and look at, and I know this wasn't the focus of the book, but nonetheless, it's a question that I was wondering about as well when I was reading. If we look back on the IS-2, when all is said and done, when the war is over and the Red Army is able to defeat its enemy on the battlefield, and that's for a lot of reasons, not just because of any one particular piece of technology. You know, a war-winning tank doesn't really exist as a concept in a war of the scale of what we're talking about here. But what was the contribution of the IS-2? Was it particularly significant? Did it have any kind of impact that we can look back and say, oh yeah, that would have been different, or it enabled this or that? Or is that just very difficult to isolate, or both?
It is quite difficult to isolate, but I can give specific contributions. The IS-2 is used as a counter to Tiger Battalions. This is openly stated in both Soviet and German documents. You know, if your army or your corps is issued a heavy tank brigade, heavy tank regiment, you can keep it in reserve as an anti-tank reserve to fight heavy tanks. If you're, you know, not breaking through powerful enemy fortifications, but you know that there's Tigers or even Panthers somewhere out there, you can use this to counter them. Now, that's not to say that T-34-85s couldn't handle Panthers or Tigers. They very much did, very commonly. But, you know, this is extra firepower that you have in at your disposal. Without this 122mm gun, having Tigers in defensive positions, setting Panthers in defensive positions would have been more troublesome. Not an insurmountable obstacle, but more troublesome. That's really the only part that like you can isolate. Whether, you know, if the IS-2, it's just a question, if the IS-2 didn't exist, what would have existed instead? Would it have been a modernized KV-85? Would it have been something like the S-51, where it's a really big gun, but on an open chassis for indirect fire? It's hard to tell. There were a ton of different competing projects that the IS-2 kind of forced out when it came into production. So maybe one of them would have gone into production. Maybe the IS-2 would have looked differently. It's hard to tell. The IS-2 disappeared in a puff of smoke, something would have taken its place. Would it be more or less effective? We don't know.
Like it is with so much of history, it is complicated, too difficult to isolate these singular variables. But nonetheless, a fascinating story about one of the key vehicles of World War II. And I guess I'll quote Stalin. I think he was talking to Churchill about Lend-Lease when he said, without it, the victory would have been a different one. I think we can probably roll with that for the IS-2 as well. The book is IS-2, Development, Design, and Production of Stalin's Warhammer. And Peter, thank you so much for joining us. I learned a lot by reading this book. I really feel like I got an insight into a world, a side of the war that I don't usually end up in contact with. And yeah, thanks a lot for joining us today. I enjoyed.
Thank you for having me.
The Real Time History Podcast is a production of Real Time History. I'm your host, Jesse Alexander, and each episode is produced by Philip Janssen. If you listen to this podcast on Nebula or Patreon, thank you so much for the support. We couldn't produce the show without you. And I'll see you in the next episode.